Hello, 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 and welcome to yet another episode of Down and Dirty with me. I'm Idaho Beau, and
I'm Vivacious Vic, and we welcome you to this show. We are very excited to continue on our journey with interviewing men in our life. We've had Matt Denning on 2 times, our major guru of permaculture, and learned so much and such inspiring conversations of doers. We're interviewing doers who are in their own communities, creating a lifestyle that is totally meaningful to each one of them. We interviewed Beau's nephew, who lives on 5 acres up in northern Idaho. And now, tonight and today.
May I interject? We cannot forget we've also had Don Newsom from BBS Radio on.
Sorry, excuse me. A very important amigo in our lives.
Yes, yes.
Who is very, very involved in this whole personal sovereignty, you know, working the land, going back to the land, honoring the land, the water, everything. So this show, we are interviewing Jay Blackhurst, who is my son-in-law, who lives on 2 acres, an hour and a half south of Boise in southern Idaho. And of course, I'm a little bit biased because I adore this person and I love him. And he's married to my daughter, and they have my granddaughter. So it's a very special time for me to be able to share this person with the greater whole. We love to hear stories. Everybody loves to tell stories, and everybody loves to hear stories. So I thought it would be interesting to ask Jay some questions as to how he came to who he is right now. And of course, I've known him for a long time, so I've watched the journey, but you never know the intimate details about things. And I would, one caveat here is I live in the house that I bought from Jay and Amy, and much of our past shows have been me sharing what has happened and transpired on this property, and also how I am reconfiguring it to fit my lifestyle and my needs and my age. And so there's so much tied in: blood, sweat, tears, family, love. And so I'm going to introduce Jay Blackhurst, and Beau and I will ask some questions, I think. But we may not need to ask that many questions, because really the first one I always want to ask people is, what got you interested in personal sovereignty? What got you started on working the land and learning, you know, how to work together with all of the rhythms of nature and the celestial bodies and whatever else you're into that got you to this place of, to me, what looks like total success? And another caveat, you should see the box of peaches that he brought tonight. They are huge, huge, bigger than softballs, perfectly ripe. And so I appreciate the bounty that we share with one another. So Jay, if you could share with us kind of some of your story and how you got where you are, and what are your ethics. I know your work ethics, but what are some of the belief systems that challenged you? Personal failures, personal successes, and it's all yours now.
Well, I guess it all kind of really started since I was born. I mean, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a gladiola grower and breeder. So he grew up, or he raised my mother at a dam up north of Boise called Air Rock Dam, and he would change the water when they called for more water. He would adjust the valves, and then he would go down to his garden, and then he had the whole day. He really didn't have to do much except for do a little bit of stuff in the morning, and then he had the rest of the day to himself. And he used to go and harvest soil from the creeks up above Air Rock Dam. He would go in the willows and he would go grab that black soil, and then he would bring it back to his garden. And from the time I remember, he always had gladiolas, and then he started a gladiola farm here in Boise, on 6 acres, sometimes 10 acres. It was all rented ground. And so from the time that I was maybe 10, no, eight, 7 or 8 years old, I was out in the field with him. So he planted 6 acres of gladiolas. And I don't know if you're familiar with gladiolas, but they're very, very hard to grow. And they need a lot of attending to. They need cultivation, and we hand planted everything. So from the time I can remember, I was always out in the field working with him in the field, working on planting in the spring, to weeding, to harvesting. And then I would drive around all the surrounding area with him in a van that was insulated and full of gladiolas, and it was freezing cold in it. It was super. He I had the air conditioner running all the time because he wanted to keep good flowers. And we drove to every florist from w extreme western Idaho all the way to central Idaho. So we would drive probably 4 days a week to deliver flowers. So I've been around plants for the most part since I was as long as I can remember. So that was my first introduction. I don't know any different. So it was kind of part of my life. And then, of course, I went through high school, and then I thought I would get a new job, and I went and worked in food service for 4 hours, and then I went back to the field. So I never really had any other job that, per se, when I was growing up, except for working for my grandfather and on the farm. And it was an urban farm too, so I kind of got the benefit of growing up on in town, but on a farm. So we would go to work on the farm, but we lived in town. So that's kind of how I got started, per se. But I guess it's I don't really know any different. And then, I went away and did high school and did some other things, and then realized that I really wanted to be more sovereign with food, water, shelter, energy. So I kind of started diving into a few more of those things. And it was easy for me to grow things because it's just like, well, my grandpa taught us, you tend the flower, you just pay attention to it, just like any other plant. So you grow potatoes and they need more water, you give them more water. And they need more hilling, so you hill them up. So I kind of, it was just innate in me. So I guess it kind of, that's where it kind of began. And then it kind of snowballed from there. And then I guess I more of, instead of learned it, I remembered it.
Oh,
I
there it is
call it
again. I love that.
my,
There it is
I
again.
call it deep remembering. Because anybody who's ever alive today, his family has made it, their ancestors have made it through all bottlenecks in humanity. So anybody alive today has the history of growing food, hunting game, building homes, all of the different skill set that it takes to live in the past. And so I never even questioned whether it was something that I knew how to do. It was already in me. And so I just really have worked. I don't even really have to work at it. I just remember. I was like, oh, I've done this before. This isn't foreign to me. When I started to saw a log or mill a log into a tree, or cut a tree down and turn it into a turn a tree into a log, and then turn it into a board and then build with it. That is, it's as old as I am, which, if my DNA is like anybody else's DNA, it's been around a long time. So it comes along. And I think oftentimes we are told that we need to think about these things and remember them, or and learn them. But I think we need to not necessarily think about them as much as we need to feel and remember.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's
Exactly.
kind of where I came. That's where, that's kind of how I've approached it more recently. I mean, in the last 15 years, I've been, in on a long, deep remembering process.
That's really fascinating because Bo and I have talked about the remembering, and it keeps coming up in many conversations, in many different circles, social media, of course, but more of the spiritually leaning people who are really awakened to the rhythms of nature and the cycles that we're all going through. The word remembering is coming up more and more and more. And I remember telling Bo just earlier this week about the remembering. I can't even remember what it was that I was re but that is such a critical piece right now for all of us, as we're letting go of all of these outworn ideas and ways, and to remember, to just be still enough and committed enough to whatever you're doing, and it bubbles up. It just bubbles up, this remembering. Oh yeah. And I find that really wonderful that you're doing that way.
I feel like as you were talking about the spiritual aspect is sitting in that stillness, and it's always best to do it when you're out in nature. But like Jay was talking about, he was in nature in a city when he was on the farm. But being connected and being still enough and quiet enough to start remembering who we are, not just what we are. And I agree with you, Jay, that you actually can connect with that epigenetic past, if you will, and your lineage. I'll tell you one thing. When I'm foraging, I'm a big forager. I do a lot of medicinal plant foraging, and whenever I can find edible foods, I will do that too. But I know it's intrinsic within me. It's not something I had to learn. It was just, and it's a huge desire too for me. So it is that remembering, and I think it's very important. And I think more of us are coming online, that's in air quotes, and remembering who we are.
Yeah, for sure. I think it easily get we often get stuck in the material aspects of it all. So I'll use a tree as an example. So the part of the tree that you can see is the trunk and the branches and the leaves. And that's the part we can actually measure and quantify. And but there's a whole entire half of the tree that we don't see. And that's the kind of mystery and the unknown. And that's kind of the I see it more as the whatever the more esoteric or spiritual side of it. But modern day has said only the aerial part of the tree exists, knowing full well that there is a whole part of the tree that is connected, is underground that you can't see. So I think about the trees all the time. I'm in a pretty good connection with trees, but I often think about not only what I can see, but what I can't see. And that is an equally important part. No, I don't know more nor less. But I think often, like the 60s hippie movement got people back to the land or whatever, but I think they just only connected with what they couldn't see. And that was just too much of the part that you couldn't see. But now I think it's important to recognize that there's this, that's for if you will, this masculine part and this feminine part that's above and below, which are equally important and it perfectly balanced. So, when somebody says, "Well, what do you think's wrong with that tree?" And sometimes they're just, they have issues, but it's not might not just be the aerial part. It could be something that's going on in the soil part. There could be a lot of different factors, but I use that as an example of how I try to see the balance of it all. There's a foundation under every home that we're all sitting in that you can't see in a crawl space and plumbing that is just as important as what you do see. So I don't know. That's kind of how I approach kind of everything now from that perspective.
The
What are you
hidden.
thinking, Vic?
Well, I'm reflecting on what you see and what you don't see, and it is so integral to, like you said, Jay, the mystery. We all want to think we have it figured out, and oh yeah, this is all I really need to know. But what do we really know? You and I talk about it all the time, Bo. I don't know anything except what is exactly in front of me in any given moment. Beyond that, I don't know what people are thinking. I don't know what any of the stuff that we hear from almost most people or most avenues of information. I don't know any of it.
Because we weren't there.
No, and really what it boils down to now for me is I don't care to know. I don't need to know. I need to really tend my own garden, weed your own garden, which means paying attention to what you're doing in your life. And are you living with integrity? Are you living with honesty? Are you helpful when somebody needs help? Those are the measures that I think are the most important ones that are so overlooked now. It's like my opinion doesn't count for anything. And, what my next brightest, shiny object is of no consequence to anybody else, and most of the time, not to me. So it boils down to, really what's inside of you. What is it that makes you tick? What is it that when you wake up every day, oh, wow, I've got another day. That's pretty cool. What am I going to do with it? And for those of us that are retired, and Jay's not retired by any means, he's got 6 cows, he's got 2 acres, he's got two properties now. He just sold one so that he can build on his big property. And so he's very busy. And he's got a teenage daughter and a wife, so he's a pretty busy guy. But the mystery is so important to acknowledge that we don't know anything. We don't know anything because it's all a mystery, really, in the end and the beginning. Anyone? Anyone?
Bueller.
Do you have any questions that you'd like to ask Jay?
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty about the property that you do have. I have not been out there. I was out to your place when you lived in the yurt. That was years ago. But Vic tells me you have the 2 acres and that you have, I don't believe you have a warm spring on your property, but you dug a trench, you built your house, you've got animals. So you want to get into some of the nitty-gritty about those aspects.
You know, we moved to this area from this home that we're in now about 13 years ago. I was, you know, we started planting fruit trees here and had a garden, but you know, I was just kind of running out of space. I guess I really needed a little more space to kind of do things. And I went to this area where we are, and it's there's a lot of geothermal water there, a lot of hot water, and then there's spring water there. So I fell in love with the place, and I travel all over the world and never felt that I was at home until I was there. And so I mean, it's a long, long story, but I ended up meeting a guy by the name of Wayne. And my grandfather's name was Wayne. So I met this guy, and he's on the same Farm All C tractor that my grandfather had. And I met him, and his name was Wayne. And I was like, oh, I'm paying attention. And
There are no coincidences.
he smelled exactly like my grandfather. And I just told him this the other day. I mean, he's known this, but I said, I'm paying attention. And he and I connected, and he was like, who is this guy? And I was just curious, and I would jump on the, he'd be swathing hay, he'd be cultivating beans, and I just jumped on the tractor and I'd ride along with him. And I didn't really have any work at the time, so I was just really curious. And so he kind of took me under his wing a little bit. And then before you know it, I was cultivating beans with him, helping him cultivate beans. And you know, usually cultivating beans is kind of a on an old 19, you know, 40s Farm All C tractor is not, you know, you can really wipe out a lot of beans really quickly. So I jumped on that tractor. I felt like I'd done it before, another remembering process. And he really opened a lot of opportunities for us to live there. And he gave us a loan to buy a yurt, which we put up on his property. He has geothermal water, artesian hot water. And I ran the water through the floor, heated that yurt. And we lived there for 3 years while we kind of got on our feet. And then we bought some property across the street that has hot water, that didn't have hot water at the time, but it had, we also have gravity-fed pressurized spring water that we irrigate with. And so we bought that property, and another neighbor had some hot water that he didn't know where to take after he had used it. And I said, well, I think I have a pretty good idea that I could use it. And so to make a long story a little shorter, we ended up buying that property, bringing hot water to it, and then building a home. So we designed and built the home. My wife's an artist, and her dad is a draftsman. And so we drew this house, this passive solar house that's heated with hot water and also passively cooled and heated. So it can be heated in many different ways. So we built this house in 2016. We started building it in the summer of 2016. It's still not done yet. I'm still working on the front door right now. So it's been a long process, but it's been really enjoyable. We lived in a tent for about 5 months while we got it kind of dry and the shelter ready for us. And then we moved in. And fortunately, we had hot water because we didn't have any insulation and the sun that helped us keep it warm. But that was the summer of or the winter of 2016, 2017, which was what
Oh,
they
that
call
was
Snowmageddon
again.
or around here.
Yeah, that was a bad
And
one.
it was a tough winter, but we made it through. And it's just been a long, you know, a process. We planted fruit trees. The first thing we did was plant some windbreak trees and fruit trees that were as big as my thumb. And now those fruit trees are about that big around now, 10 years later. So that was kind of like some of the first things we did. We planted raspberries and blackberries and grapes and I don't know, currants, all kinds of different things, you know. So it was, you know, kind of a home that could kind of sustain itself. I don't really like to use that word, but it was, you know, it's a productive home. It
Yeah.
produces a lot of food. It produces a lot of connection to the cosmos. I didn't realize building a passive solar house with all south-facing windows, how much I didn't know about the process of the sun and the moon. But that house taught
Wow.
me all of those things. I mean, it taught me, it's just still teaching me more stuff.
Yeah.
Like where I see the moon hit the house in the summertime is where the sun hits the house in the wintertime. So all these different aspects, I mean, it's all that kind of stuff that I really have to show it to somebody to understand it, because it's really hard to describe. But I'm not very really that great at articulating those experiences unless I'm in front of them. So not being in there, I could show you in person, but it's been a real ex amazing process to create, build, farm. You know, we have 5 cows now, and you know, we put up an acre of hay. So we put up enough hay on an acre to feed the cows that are on a neighbor's property of 3 acres. So we have our own beef, and we produce our own bone broth, tallow. And yeah, it's a place of, I don't know, abundance. I mean, we really have a lot of fun. I mean, I have to often pinch myself as about how much fun we get to have on a daily basis, just doing whatever it is that we're doing. I came home the other day, and Amy was making pesto, and she just harvested all the basil. And you know, I'm working on the front door that's made out of an old water tank that was Buell's water tank during the you know, early 1900s, and that door is, you know, going to be the entrance to our home made out of redwood.
Nice.
So
That's so nice.
it's just a project of, you know, it just continues to kind of grow on itself, and it's kind of turned into this big oak tree itself, the whole entire project that just keeps growing.
I have a few things that I can add to that, witnessing this project over the years, and being able to go down and share, stay in the house. They cooked on a chef, a King Chef, three burner camp stove. They cooked on that for what, how many years?
6 years,
6 years.
seven
And
years.
yeah, a long time. They didn't really have a kitchen, but they had a kitchen, and man, did things come out of that kitchen. But another thing that I learned from Jay is taking over the property here that I bought from the kids. So many of the different vegetable plants that he grew here, they went to seed, and lettuce, spinach, chard, lots of greens had a permanent place here, and they just seeded themselves every year. And they would migrate to different places on the property every, where they were stronger and more nutrients. And it was kind of like this traveling lettuce beds that, and I witnessed that at their house to this day. Every year, I mean, they've had cilantro and lettuce. Huge amounts of cilantro and lettuce that they let go to seed every year. And I mean, it's the first thing up in the spring. They've got greens coming out, and then load after load after load every year of wood chips would come in, and for the driveway and to, to drive on and stuff. So they actually dug all that up this year and made this huge pile of wood chips on one end of their property. And now there's chard, spinach, lettuce, potatoes,
Cucumber.
cucumbers, all growing in this pile of wood chips just from scraping it up and all the seeds that and plants. And to me, that is fascinating because it's a ongoing source of food that is acclimated to that property. And it just keeps on giving and giving and giving, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to even plant any of them. And I find that really fascinating. And Tesla, their daughter and my granddaughter, over the years, she's just a little tyke when they started building the house, and She knows every tool. She helped her dad build his house. And Amy was a very, very busy artist in a lot of that first years of building. So she was on a lot of art projects, and Tesla and Jay would help build this house. And she knew every tool, and Amy would go to get a tool for something, and Tesla would correct her. That's not the right tool, Mom. You know, this is what you need. And she'd go get it. So they homeschooled their kid. And I mean, what an amazing testimony to an education for a child living in the country, and they have chickens. And I think, did Tesla help you build the chick shop?
Yeah, she did.
They have this thing they call the chick shop, which is a chicken coop on wheels, kind of like a Chinese rickshaw that you would pull around a person in it. Well, it's for chickens, so they can move it anywhere on their property. And they have a little electrified fence around it. And they've had that thing for years.
Yeah, we probably had it about 12 years.
Yeah, and the chickens are happy, and they move that thing around on the property just like a chicken tractor, but they have the little electrical fence around it, so the chickens are doing great work on the property. So it's been fun to witness these different innovative ways of living that are so natural. It's like Jay also learned about lavender. You've got to tell us about the lavender.
Yeah, Lofton lavender has it's hard to germinate because the seed, if it's harvested, often needs to be scarified or sanded, or roughed up, and then it needs to be stratified. So oftentimes you have to put in the freezer. But I was out one spring pulling some weeds next to the lavender, and it was a windy day, and I hear a little bit of a noise. It was kind of a rattle noise, and I don't cut the, oftentimes people cut the seed pods off in the fall. And I like to let plants go all the way so they can have their full expression from, seed to seed, essentially. This from the seed to producing a seed. So I left the lavender flowers on, and then I hear, well, in the wind, a little tiny rattle. And this is in the spring after it had gone through, all of winter. And it occurred to me, like, oh, well, that's the scarification or the sanding of the seed. And the winter is the stratification, if you want to be technical about it, of the seed. So now it should be ready to plant. Well, then I thought, well, what happens if you just leave it in the pod? And they're kind of an umbel flower, and it faces up. So the seed pod's up, so it kind of has to fall over in order for that seed to come out. Well, sure enough, like 2 or 3 weeks later, I looked underneath all the mama plants, and there's a whole bunch of lavender, little small lavender starts. And I thought, we tried to germinate it many times, and we'd never get any to germinate.
Me either.
Almost impossible to germinate. Well, after this, we just started transplanting lavender. We had more lavender than we can imagine. And we started giving them away to people, and the seeds got a start on their own, and we never had to get involved with the whole process of trying to sand a little tiny seed and put it in the freezer. It's like it knows what to do on its own.
So
So
did you take the dried seed pod on the stalk and turn the stalks upside down, like
no, I
break
just
them?
let it do it. I let it do it on
Let
its own. And so
naturally.
it's perfectly timed to be the
Good to
right time
know.
to get to the perfect time to drop its seed in the springtime. And they usually come right underneath the mama plant, underneath the mother.
Good to know. I have some lavender in my very, very small garden. I live in an apartment, and I've been really tempted to cut the flower heads off and use them. I make a bunch of different botanical lotions and potions and what have you, but I've been hesitating because I want the pollinators to have as much food as they can before the cold weather sets in. And now I'm glad I haven't because I'm going to be checking underneath those plants come springtime.
Yeah, if you let them go all through the summer, I mean, they usually around here anyways, they bloom in
Late
late
June,
June, and
yeah.
then all the way into like almost to mid-July is when they're finished. So I harvest a lot of the flowers and then make essential oil with those.
Right.
But we have a lot of lavender, so I mean, we have many, many plants. I mean, it lines our whole entire driveway. So
It's a hedge.
it's like
Wow.
a hedge of lavender. So we have a
Beautiful.
lot of a lavender. So
Oh.
it's hard, you know, I can't harvest it all. It's so much to harvest. So, you know, I harvested and made maybe 15 milliliters of essential oil this spring or this summer, and I didn't even put a dent in it. So we have a bunch of seed pods up now, but I haven't been harvesting more of that lavender. We could start a nursery. You could start a nursery just on letting things go to seed
Yes.
and not even and let them start in the ground and then dig them up and then pot them, or just, you know, give them to people that way.
That's what
Yes.
that's what I do with my goji berries. In fact, my goji berries are so crowded from so many babies that they're kind of not producing as much as they could if I give them more space. But they see themselves and got the red hot pokers from Jay, and they have a whole red hot poker farm in one little section. Because, but it's true, just letting enough of your plants go to seed and do their full cycle. And I, for my the third year in a row now, I've got some chard going to seed right where it wants to grow, and I'll be harvesting that seed again. It's kind of, and Jay says, well, it's becoming a perennial. And in a
Yeah.
way, it really is.
Yeah. Well, chard especially is a biennial, so it comes on every other, you know, it sends seed every other year. So it, you know, you can kind of turn annuals into perennials if you let them produce, you know, because in a seed pack, let's say you get a lettuce seed pack, you might get 200 seeds. But if you let one plant go to seed, you might get
10 billion.
10,000 or 20
Yeah,
seeds.
exactly.
So now you're increasing the odds of having, if you let it go to seed and fall in the ground, a lot of those seeds aren't going to be good, but the most viable for your place are they're going to take. And so
Exactly.
that's why, you know, when you buy seeds, you're usually getting seed from some other place, and you never know how much of you're going to get. Most of the time, your people germ test those seeds and see if they're any good. Of course, they're going to germinate, but when it self-selects itself, like in the forest, you know, you're going to get the most optimized seed and plants for your particular place. And that can change from one spot on your garden in your garden to another. Because,
Do
you know,
you save seed? Do you have like a seed vault?
I used to save seeds like crazy, and we have a lot of seeds, but I figured out not save saving seed is best on the plant or in the ground.
Yeah, that
So
makes a lot of sense.
I kind of stopped saving seed, and people say, "Well, do you have any lettuce seed?" I'm like, "No." Well, right now I have a whole bunch of lettuce seed, but I just scattered it all around, and then the rest I fed to the cows because they ate it all. You know, I figured out I don't have compost bins anymore. I used to keep big, complicated compost bins and do worm composting and all that stuff. Used to make worm compost tea, but then it occurred to me, like, why am I doing all this labor? And I let loose all the worms into the yard, and I turned the whole entire yard into a worm compost farm.
Nice.
And then the cows compost faster than anything else, so I will feed almost all of the garden scraps to the cows. And they eat most of it. What they don't eat, gets trampled back into the ground, into the pasture.
Are all of your cows meat cows, or do you have dairy cows too?
No, just meat cows.
Okay.
We don't have any dairy cows. I do have one cow and a heifer that is we just got a little bull calf. So he's going to be breeding those two. We could turn one into a milk cow, but I mostly have them for beef at this point. So,
It's the best meat ever. It
I, my
is.
My sister used to have, when they lived in Montana, they had a herd of about 30. And I don't eat meat anymore, but I agree with you. It was the best meat I'd ever had.
Yeah, it's nice. You kind of get spoiled. You only eat that meat now. I don't eat any other meat.
We covet that meat.
Yeah,
At family gatherings, is Jay bringing? Oh, yeah, this is going to be good.
we butcher one cow a year, so we have enough for ourselves and a couple of neighbors. So.
Something that's very interesting to me that when you were still living in the house that Vicky owns now that she bought from you, and correct me if I'm wrong in my remembering this, but at one point you went to a bunch of your neighbors on your block and ones behind you and tried to start a cooperative of people with chickens and other things like that. Could you talk about that at all?
Yeah, there was a little alleyway in the back that was never, it was blocked on both ends. It was going to be an alley like, older homes had. And somehow there was a park that blocked one end, and then it never really got incorporated into anything. And so it kind of got blocked off, and it was just this no man's land that was where the ditch ran, because it was an irrigation ditch that runs back there. And so I started thinking, well, why don't we plant some fruit trees back here and start turn some chickens out? And so we did. We started turning chicken. We turned some chickens out there, planted trees, and the neighbors got involved. And it was a great project. It kind of brought a lot of the neighbors together because they wanted to participate in it. And it really taught me more about what I thought community was supposed to look like, because the people next door to you are some of the most important people in your life if once you recognize it. And they might have different political views, they might have different religious beliefs, they might have different whatever, doesn't matter. But they're the ones that you see every day. So I started to invest a lot of time and energy into those relationships. And I didn't realize how important they were until I moved away from here and started to do it in a rural setting. In a town, in a city, it's a lot easier because people don't really need each other. But when we moved to a rural place, we have elderly widows that live next door and close by that need a lot of help, and they really need to rely on somebody that's close by, that because some of them don't have family close by. And so this doing that little chicken coop in the back alleyway, no man's land, kind of showed me what the power of what community, or I don't like really like to use that word so much because it gets overused, but isn't it, community isn't created or built, it's realized.
Ooh,
And
I'm writing that one down.
I learned a lot about that because people say, well, we need to create community or we need to build community. And I was like, no, we just really need to realize it. And it's all around us all the time, whether it's the plants, the animals, or the people. It's everywhere around us, and we just have to jump into it. And people think, well, I don't know those people, I don't really like them, whatever. It's one of those things that they're the best asset that anybody has right next door, because they're going to notice something. And if they're participating in their life and you're participating in your life, and they can kind of work together, and before you know it, they're recognizing things that you might not see, and vice versa. And I learned so much from this place here in the city about that, that when I moved out there, it was like, oh, and that's how everybody operates in the rural, because you don't have any other choices. It's hard for urban people to do it because we can go to the grocery store, we can go buy eggs, we don't have to worry about, any of those facets of life. So, yeah, I was just able to expound on it in where I live now in a rural setting that it's like, oh, well, everybody work operates that way. So.
Nice. I love, the fact that, and it's so true about neighbors who live on, there's 14 houses on this block, both sides of the street. And I notice so much about every coming and going with every single neighbor. You know everybody's car, you know when they go to work, you know when they come home, you know the sound of their dog, their cats, some of them roam around in your garden. And I saw a mouse right out, a dead mouse right in front of my in my yard just today. And I said, thank you, because I got a lot of mice here. And so you do, you notice that, but do you reach out and offer anything? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But it really, when you really boil it down to that, it really is, it's home. You go to some other neighborhood, you don't know anybody, you don't know anything about them, but here you drive home and a little bit, a little tiny bit about every single house on this block. And that is a sense of well-being somehow, even without a huge interaction with a lot of them. So that would be a really good definition of an urban community, even if you're not really doing that much together.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that everybody needs to do everything together. It's just when you're in a denser situation, you it's harder because there's less and less trust in the people around you. That
Exactly.
it's harder to engage, and then harder to figure out how, you know, what skill sets somebody might have, or what, you know, whatever they might be into, you just don't, people just aren't getting into those spaces. In a rural environment, we have no choice.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, if I don't plow the neighbor's driveway, she's not getting out, you know, in the winter time. So consequently, I'd have, you know, it's a big part of my life, and I'm fortunate to have enough time to be able to engage with a lot of those neighbors and communities. And they've offered so many amazing gifts, and you know, we have a pretty amazing relationships that I'm externally grateful for, because without them, you know, my best interest is their best interest, and if I'm looking out for their best interest, they're probably looking out for my best interest. And I think if people operated in that way, we don't have to believe all the same things, but if we operate in that way, then, you know, less and less people get bound by any particular system.
Well, it's basic humanity. It's about sharing our humanity, right? Not ideas. I mean, there's a lot of ideas that you share with those kind of folks. But ideologies and all those other surface things, but the humanity that, and the character that comes out when you get to know these different people. And I've had that happen here, I mean, I've really got to know a couple of my neighbors this summer, and she's going, I can't believe this. I can't believe that I just get my groceries from you now. She buys little shares for my little garden, and I make kombucha for her, and her kids, love it. And so it's learning the most basic things. I mean, I do this all the time, but who would have thought how much my neighbor would appreciate it, Till I told her about it. I told her about it. She goes, you're kidding. You do all that? So it's really fun to just talk. You got to talk to them. How are we doing on time?
We have about 7 more minutes.
7 more minutes.
Yes, ma'am.
So Jay, I and Bo and I both ask these questions of our different guests. For somebody that has a desire to maybe start this journey of getting back to the land and, starting to be a little more self-sufficient. What would your advice be to somebody who's curious enough to maybe dip their toe in the water or transform their backyard or something into?
I think the biggest, I think the most important aspect of all this is to start. Bo, you live in an apartment.
Yes.
You can still have a potted garden, right?
Yes.
And you do.
Definitely.
And I think that's the place to start. Don't, people say, well, if I had a piece of land, or if I only had a house with a backyard, the trick is to start. And then let it teach you, or let you remember it. Because I think it wants to teach whatever it is, wants to teach as much as we're willing to learn and notice, whether it's the hummingbird coming in to check out the lavender flowers on your patio, or whatever it might be. There's, I think it's important just to start. And that can be buying a pack of seeds, and spending as much time as you can outside. I think I can't stress that enough now with people saying they have anxiety and depression. We used to do a WOOF program where we'd have young people that would come and stay and work for 4 hours a day, and in exchange for room and board. And we had a guy who was a PhD student in economics, who was a great track athlete, who had had anxiety and depression his whole entire life, since he, as long as he can remember. He had been treat had every gone through every treatment modality there was, and it, nothing had worked. And he was 1 year into his PhD program, and he told his parents, he said, I'm quitting, I'm gonna go and woof for a year. And they said, you're gonna what? They had no idea what he was talking about. You're gonna woof. And by the time he got to our house, he was 3 weeks into his project, and he had been on a peach farm in, I think, Grand Junction, Colorado, for 3 weeks before us. And he told me, he said, I've been through all these treatment modalities. I've been picking up peach cuttings and working around this farm, and now helping you guys out. And you know what has happened to my anxiety and depression? They're gone. He said, I don't know, it's not there anymore. And I think just being outside is the antidote to any problem at this point. It really is just being outside. And if you can be fortunate enough to be outside and be dealing with your own sustenance, meaning growing food, building things in some form of creation, all those types of things, whatever problem will fade away. And I think that's probably the most important thing, is just get your ass outside. That's it. Get your ass outside. You see what happens if you just go outside, and everything will change. And if you can do that and go help somebody, even if it's go help the neighbor with a project, or open the door for an old lady at the grocery store, that kind of stuff will help people to realize that it's more than just them.
Give
Because
somebody a smile.
just a smile and a gesture of appreciation for whoever they are. But that's what nature, that's what being outside does all the time. And I think for me, I have a hard time being inside now.
Me
I
too.
really have a hard time being inside. I mean,
I have anxiety and not depression yet of the thought of winter coming, and then I'm not. So I've got to
well,
really
it,
buckle up and
but
get
it, but you just have to
outside.
put the right clothes on
You
and
know,
go. I
that's
mean,
right. I have to do 4 times a day with my dog girlfriend, so I don't want
I
to hear
know.
it.
No,
No, I know, but I get it because I am outside most of the day doing something, small, big, little project, farming, gardening, whatever. And I think we're running to the end of our show here, but being a creator is what we're here to do, is to create. That is, and we just need to figure out what we're good at creating because everybody has a gift. I do believe every soul comes here with some kind of a gift. And sharing it is leveling up to what we're here to do.
It's that remembering, going back to the
Remembering,
remembering. Yeah.
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Jay,
Jay.
I have chills. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. We might ask you back sometime.
I'd love to.
Excellent.
Maybe you can come to the house.
I would love to. Next time in Boise, I was going to ask you if I could have an invitation, but you beat me to
You're
it.
that's what I love to do the most is come, I'm an analog man, so I mean I tell my wife that all the time. I'm the analog man. I want to be in person at people most of the time.
Yes, definitely.
Like,
Definitely.
so yeah, you have to come next time.
I will. I will. Thank you so much, Vic. Have a great weekend, both of you. I love you both
Yes.
so much. Thank
Okay,
you
take
to
care.
BBS Radio. Thank you so much. Thomas, Doug, Don, we love you. And all of our subscribers and listeners, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank
Cue the
you.
music, Thomas. Bye.
Bye.